Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, June 28th. Today, Tracy Ross, the Colorado Sun's rural economic development reporter, sits down with Kevin Fidarko, the New York Times best-selling author of The Emerald Mile, to discuss his latest book. Before we begin, want to breathe easier this summer? Take simple steps for better air and help reduce harmful ground-level ozone in your Front Range community. Learn more at simplestepsbetterair.org. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. Did you know President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Taylor Grazing Act on this date in 1934? This act, named after Congressman Edward T. Taylor, reorganized the management of government-owned lands. Previously, these lands were sold to settlers, but by the 1930s, drought and the Great Depression required a new approach. The act established grazing districts and fees for ranchers using public land, promoting sustainable use. It laid the foundation for the Bureau of Land Management, which was created in 1946, balancing access and control of federal lands. Before we continue, as a locally owned business, Applewood prides itself on delivering exceptional plumbing, heating, and electrical services to the people of Colorado. Their team of licensed and certified professionals will tackle any home comfort issues you might have, as they always have for 50 years. Because when you choose Applewood, you're not just investing in their services, but also their employees and families. You're investing back into your community. Applewood Plumbing, Heating, and Electric. Locally owned, family operated for 50 years. Learn more at applewoodfixit.com. Next, our feature story.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us for another Daily Sunup podcast. It's Friday, so hopefully you're either off or have something adventurous planned this weekend. I'm Tracy Ross, the Colorado Sun's Rural Economic Development Reporter, and today I'm excited to have a very special guest, Kevin Fidarko, the New York Times bestselling author of The Emerald Mile, a thrilling story about the fastest boat ride ever down the 277 miles of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, and his new book, which everyone is talking about, which just recently has been on the cover of the New York Times Book Review with a beautiful review, and which I'm in the middle of reading right now and absolutely loving. I literally plowed through 200 pages in like 12 hours, something. It's just so beautifully written. And it's called A Walk in the Park, The True Story of a Spectacular Misadventure in the Grand Canyon. Kevin, thanks so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule, talking to all the people who've fallen in love with this book, to chat with the Colorado Sun.
Hey, Tracy, it's good to hear your voice. It's been a long time. I'm glad to have a conversation with you.
Awesome. Yeah, just a little background. So Kevin and I have known each other for a while. He has had sort of a varied career, started out as an editor at Time Magazine, then an editor at Outside, and then you ventured into books. Kevin, let's really quickly just give the readers a sense of your career, and particularly as it pertains to this book, when you sort of dove off the cliff of normal jobs and became a guide, well, tried to become a guide on the Colorado River.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I moved west for the first time in, I think it was the winter of 1998, from New York City to begin a job at Outside Magazine in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I felt myself being pulled away from editing and towards writing, and realized that I was interested in also moving away from daily and monthly magazine journalism and immersing myself in longer pieces of writing that required a deeper relationship with an understanding of, I wanted a relationship with a particular place in the American West, and it didn't particularly matter to me where that was, but I wanted to connect to it deeply enough that I could begin to understand it and see it and observe it and be part of it, not just for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, but across the arc of, a season and then a year, and then maybe to see the years roll through it. And it was with that mindset that I found myself driving from Santa Fe to Flagstaff in, I believe it was the spring of 2003 through a late winter snowstorm. And my destination was a river outfitter in Flagstaff that was conducting what your listeners may recognize as a woofer course, a wilderness first responder course. It was being run inside the Grand Canyon. I stepped into that boathouse, not realizing that that was a moment that was about to change my life. And I was greeted by this, you know, a vision of this little fleet of wooden rowboats. I didn't know at the time they were Grand Canyon whitewater dories designed for the Colorado River inside the Grand Canyon. And I just fell in love with them right there in that moment. Partly it was the simplicity and the beauty of their lines, partly it was their bright colors. And I decided I was going to have to find a way to suspend my titanically unsuccessful career at that point as a freelance writer, a freelance magazine writer. By that point, I was doing less and less work for outside and quit my job and allow those boats to become kind of emissaries and draw me into and introduce me to this world, the world that we who love the Grand Canyon, and you're part of this, Tracy, refer to as the world beneath the rims, and allow those boats to take me into it and show me what it was and what they could do inside of it and what the connection was between the boats and the secret hidden world of whitewater at the bottom of the canyon. So I've kind of lost track of whether I'm answering your question or not, but that was
You are. So, okay. So you left your world. You were in the writing world. You left the world and you were, I think, doing a story actually. And you went and you saw these boats. You fell in love with them. All of a sudden, what you were like age 38, when most people are like, oh, I should, you know, get married, have kids, get a career, da da da. You were like, I think I'll go be a guide on the Colorado. And that did not go as planned.
No. And I mean, it's important to acknowledge it was just like a monumentally stupid thing to do. I was in my mid or late 30s. I can't recall how old I was, but I mean, I didn't think that there were any ways that you could earn less money than you earn as a freelance magazine writer. But, you know, it turns out that, yes, there is a really effective way to earn less money than that, which is to work as an unpaid apprentice river guide in the Grand Canyon. And, you know, I kind of, when I saw those boats, like I just, this dream kind of just materialized in the air in front of me. I wanted in the worst possible way to be a Grand Canyon dory guide. And I'm pausing for a moment here because what I'm about to say is viewed as sort of blasphemous and offensive by a number of people who are part of the river culture in the Grand Canyon, but I'm going to say it anyhow. The people who row dories kind of sit at the top of the hierarchy in the Grand Canyon. And the reason for that is simply that unlike rubber rafts or unlike giant motor rafts, you know, a dory is a hard-hauled, it's a delicate thing. It's a fragile piece of equipment. And if you smash into or brush against or even kind of flirt with a rock, you will tear or smash that thing to pieces. And so the skill set that's required is pretty refined in terms of getting those boats safely through the cauldrons of whitewater that stud the bottom of the canyon. And I kind of thought, well, yeah, I want to be one of these guys. And I didn't realize that like nobody walks onto the deck of a dory and takes the oar handles in their hands and just pronounces themselves a dory guide. And I learned over the course of that first summer that I really sucked. You know, I was a terrible boatman. I was colossally incompetent when it came to rowing whitewater and reading whitewater. I'd never done any of that before. I was not a river person. I didn't have like this skill set that I'd acquired over years and years. And so the only way that I was able to stay in the canyon and continue to learn about that place and connect to it was by becoming a permanent part of what we call the baggage pool and rowing bags, because nobody was going to give me the oar handles of a Grand Canyon dory and let me take clients' lives literally in the palms of their hands.
Right. And okay, so you just brought up a few different things that I so appreciate about you. One is something that my son Scout also has, and I kind of call it the Forrest Gump effect. which is you look at this incredibly dangerous thing, rowing dories down the Colorado through the Grand Canyon, and you think, oh, I can do that. You don't see the danger of it somehow. B, you have the gumption to walk up, and it's like this, almost this sort of beautiful lack of self-awareness where you go, hey, choose me, I can do this. And then the even better part in my mind is you get out there, you run into some rocks, like it's, you know, they are mad at you. They do not want you to be there. And you want to be there so right. badly that you're like, I'll carry the poop. And what's so cool about it is that you make things happen for yourself. You don't give up. And it's this unconventional way of doing it that's like full of innocence. And somehow it works for you because now look at, you know, we transitioned to this book. And it was a little bit of the same scenario with you and Pete getting on this trip to hike the Grand Canyon. So if you wouldn't mind, we can back up a little bit and tell us a little bit about this book and this journey that you went on, that your same beautiful qualities got you on.
I mean, thank you for saying all those nice things about me. I would like to think that your son, that his approach, you know, embraces a dimension of courage and nobility that coexists with that theme of cluelessness. In my case, that's not the case. You know, a lot of it is just idiocy and inability to see how poor the decision-making tree is that I'm attempting to climb up. But
it's
just
amazing.
To cut through it really quickly, like I had this, you know, it was a period of about 6 years. I stayed in the canyon. I apprenticed myself to the dories. I discovered a story down there, a story about a legendary river guide named Kenton Grua, who set a speed record in a little boat called the Emerald Mile through the canyon in the spring of 1983 by putting the boat illegally into the river at the crest of a historic flood and using that flood as a kind of hydraulic slingshot to propel him and two other boatmen and the boat itself all the way from Lee's Ferry to the Grand Wash Cliffs faster than, you know, anybody had ever done before in recorded history. And that book came out in the spring or the summer of 2013. And at that point, I figured I was done with the Grand Canyon and was ready to move on to the next thing. And that's the point where something deeply problematic occurred. I have someone in my life, a friend and a professional collaborator, P. McBride, the great National Geographic photographer and filmmaker. And we have a history of doing some rather harebrained projects, magazine assignments that over the last 20 years have taken us all over the world and gotten us into a very great deal of trouble, largely because the two of us have failed together to engage in a sufficient level of preparation and homework. But the way I like to tell the story is that that's all Pete's fault, and he has dragged me into these projects. And each one has been kind of more challenging than the last, but by far the most challenging of them all was, you know, when he came to me right after the Emerald Mile came out and basically said, look, you may think you're done with the canyon, but the canyon is not done with you. And the reason is that this guy that you wrote about that's at the center of your book, Kenton Grua, who set a speed record in a boat, like 5 years earlier, he did something even more impressive. He was the first person in recorded history, which is to say modern history, to figure out how to walk from one end of Grand Canyon National Park to the other, a journey that the river takes about 277 miles to do. But if you're on foot, weaving into and back out of side canyons and climbing up and down cliffs and whatever, and because there's no trail whatsoever, takes about 750 miles. And Pete's like, we're going to do this. And the reason you're going to say yes, even though you know better, is because it is will be irresistible for you to follow in the footsteps of this person who you've already written one book about in terms of his connection to the river, but who has this whole other dimension to his story and illuminates and opens up a whole other dimension to the Grand Canyon, which is not the world of the river at the bottom. It's the world of the rock, the matrix of cliffs and ledges that is suspended between the edges of the Colorado River and the rims of the canyon. And we're going to explore that world together on foot. You're going to do this with me. And it's not going to be that hard. In fact, we don't really have to be in shape for it because the hike itself is going to get us into shape, and it's going to be a walk in the park, literally a walk in Grand Canyon National Park. So that's kind of the lead in to the nightmare that ensued from that.
Yes. And okay, I have to say, for a Colorado audience, you know, everyone in Colorado thinks they're so hardcore and that's like a piece of our identity, when in reality, like, there's a reality also. And I did absolutely love the fact, this idea, this theme of off the couch, which kind of goes through for a little while in the book. But I was truly and honestly blown away that Kevin Fargo and Pete McBride, who are already well known in some circles, one might say many circles, for being these like badass adventurers. You know, you reported on like the border of what, China and Pakistan, on this story for Skiing Magazine, and you know, in a war zone. I remember that story and just like falling in love with your writing and like your chutzpah and everything. And then to read in this book that you received all of this gear. So you didn't open a map, I don't think. You were like, oh, you guys found this expert group of people to go with, which I understand this. You were like, okay, we're with these experts. We're going to be fine. Then all this gear shows up. It's all in boxes. You don't even open the boxes. Kevin, why? Yeah. I mean, until you got to the trail, what was going on?
I mean, this is probably an opportunity for me to issue a correction, because Pete has recently expressed some consternation over the manner in which I've depicted him. And, you know, the fact is that, like, we did engage in some preparation, like, particularly Pete. Like, he did a great deal of work, like, arranging for the permits for this thing and ordering up the gear and contacting people such as this group of hikers who were going to allow us to accompany them on the first leg of our hike through the canyon. He spent an enormous amount of energy and time laying the groundwork for this hike, while also kind of signaling to me that everything was going to be okay if I didn't fully get my act together, because he would kind of pull me through like a locomotive pulls a caboose. And the other thing that's not revealed in this book, I don't think I've spoken about this publicly anywhere, but I just put it out there for the people in Colorado who, like you, Tracy, are wondering, like, how stupid can you actually be? I mean, I was actually, I didn't open any of the boxes. I took the boxes from my front porch and threw them into the garage and figured that I was going to get to them at some point. But I was on deadline for a whole nother book. I was ghostwriting a book for an American soldier who, it was a story of a battle that took place in eastern Afghanistan, a military outpost that was overrun by the Taliban, how this soldier basically, you know, they almost lost the entire outpost. He lost 9 of his own men. And then he staged a counterattack and retook the post and saved everybody else. And I was finishing this as I was supposed to be preparing for the hike. And that is not part of this book, because I don't feel like it needs to be a part of this book. But to the extent that people may be dismissing the story as either exaggerated or made up, it's not made up. It's just that there is this other additional piece of context that's part of the story. But yes, you're right. We showed up at Lee's Ferry on the night before the hike was supposed to start without having opened a single box of gear. It took us probably 10 minutes to find the box with the headlamps, the black diamond headlamps, and then the batteries, and turn them on so we could begin to figure out how to unbox the Patagonia underwear and the camp stove and the fuel canisters and the shoes and everything else. And yeah, it was, and all of that, I have to say, is a testament to something else, which is important and which is a dimension to this story. This is a very, very serious, formidable, gorgeous, important piece of landscape. And there's no excuse for not showing up prepared, even if the excuse is that you're writing a story about a bunch of American soldiers who lost their lives in Afghanistan. The canyon demands a level of focus and respect and attention and homework and preparation. Pete made an effort to engage in that. I did not. And boy, did we pay the price from the moment that we left Lee's Ferry the next morning.
Oh, I'm so glad that you told us that, because of course, I mean, you're a working journalist now, you know, working book author, and you have to, like, you have a job, you have to make a living. So that makes sense to me that you're on deadline and you're going to go on this kind of extended trip and you've got to get that done. Like, I get it. I'm so glad you added that. And I also love that you just brought up that this whole idea of preparedness and what the canyon demands, because that was another part, or that is another part of this book that I think is just so beautiful. How you spool out, you know, among this. I mean, first of all, I love the various sort of subtle narratives that are going on at the same time. So there's the narrative of the hike itself. There's the narrative of your history with the canyon and falling in love with it and the ways that you have interacted with it in the past. There's this beautiful friendship. And then as we're reading along and as you go along, you're having these amazing epiphanies about both the canyon and yourself. And I have really been struck by that one in particular that you just brought up, this theme, this idea of like beneath the rim, beneath the depth, you know, the depths below what we can see is, is this a physical world, but also this like symbolic and emotional and spiritual world that you, I felt like you kept having to self-examine as you were going along. And as you were able to listen deeper to what it was telling you that you needed to do. And I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit. Sorry, that's a lot in one question.
No, and it touches on something that's also important, which I haven't mentioned yet, that's integral to this experience, at least in my view. So, you know, I mentioned a moment ago that, you know, I had written an entire book on the river world inside of Grand Canyon. And Pete had undertaken, I don't know how many river trips Pete had done through the canyon at that point, but this was a world that was familiar to us. And again, I kind of want to speak for myself here and not so much for both of us, but when I finished The Emerald Mile, the book on the speed run, and that book came out, not only did I think, okay, I'm done with the Grand Canyon, I also thought I'm kind of an expert on the Grand Canyon. I mean, I just wrote this like 430, whatever page number count is, 430 page book, you know, about the river itself and the history of the river and the human history of the river and the hydrology and the hydrodynamics and the Glen Canyon Dam, and the engineering inside of that dam and the rapids inside of the canyon. Boy, do I know a lot. Like I'm one of the premier experts on whitewater and the Grand Canyon. Let's face it, and most of the people listening to this will be saying this to themselves, that's pretty ludicrous. What I'm trying to get at is that there was an element of hubris and arrogance that devolved from the act of having written this rather large book in the first place that gave me the unstated impression that, like, I knew this place, I knew this world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this journey with Pete, it was going to involve like putting one foot in front of the other and carrying a bunch of weight on our backs. And maybe it was going to get hot or cold, but like, I'd been there before. This wasn't anything. The rapids of the canyon had not already thrown at me. There was nothing new that was going to be coming. So to your question about like the process of, you know, this parallel journey, you know, there's the physical journey through the canyon itself, moving on foot. And then there's, you know, this, Tracy, this is always the case with you, with your books, with your journeys. There is a parallel journey that unfolds alongside of the physical journey or hovers perhaps above it. Mm-hmm. It's an abstract journey. It's a journey of ideas and insights and learning and evolution or devolution of character and a whole bunch of other things. And that's what you write. Is you write about the space between those journeys. You weave between the physical and the emotional or the abstract. And that is how you create the arc of a narrative that speaks to people in a way that hopefully goes beyond just like bragging about this cool thing that you did. And so the element that became, it was there from the very beginning and it emerged as one of, if not the most important elements, was this arrogance and this hubris that I brought with me. Inside my backpack, right? That was part of the weight that was inside 55 pounds, whatever the hell it was that I left Lee's Ferry with in September of 2015. You know, a big chunk of that weight was the arrogance and the hubris that I brought with me. And what the canyon will do, and you know this, anybody who's listening knows this. The first thing the canyon does, in the same manner in which the erosive forces of nature, wind and water, and the application of deep time strip the landscape bare to expose the bones that lie underneath it. The canyon itself does that to you. It strips you bare. It removes all those layers of kind of, you know, self-regard and grandiosity and blowheartedness. And it reveals, for better and in my case, for worse, you know, what's underneath. And then it leaves you with the challenge and the question of like, okay, what are you going to do with that? So a huge part of this journey was the canyon stripping me bare and then delivering, having done that, deliver what I feel is one of the most, if not the essential insight that like this landscape has to deliver. There's no other national park anywhere in America where you can immerse yourself so deeply in a world whose ramparts are framed by mile-high ramparts of rock whose bloodlines run back like 1.9 billion years, a third the lifespan of the planet. And it's impossible to be inside of that world and not spend a great deal of time thinking about how little we matter. We, like you and me as individual people, but also we as human beings, human history, human civilization. The insight the canyon delivers is a level of humility which can fundamentally alter, sometimes in the space of a single heartbeat when it hits you for the very first time, a profound realignment of perspective in which you realize that you're not at the center of anything important. We're not at the center of anything important. The world, the universe that we are privileged to be a part of and alive inside of for this brief and ephemeral moment is shaped and created, and its destiny is written by forces that are so much grander and larger than any of us that the only appropriate response to it is being incredibly humble. That's what this landscape teaches you, or at least it teaches me. And so I've never said this before. This idea just popped into my head right now. But like the mistakes that I made, the mistakes that Pete and I made together, the hubris and the arrogance that I embraced, that was actually pretty important because it provided a starting point for an arc of growth and understanding that could not have taken place otherwise.
I mean, that comes through in spades. Oh my God, there's so much we could talk about. But yeah, I think that comes through initially when you guys just get your butts completely handed to you. I mean, in a very serious way, Pete almost, I mean, Pete could have died. And
easily.
And then, I mean, definitely took my breath away when I read that. And so then you come out of the canyon and there's a couple things going on. One is, you know, you have had yourselves broken down, and amazingly have this group of people who starts out where you go on a hike with this original crew, and you think, oh, you know, once you guys have to get out of the canyon early, once you leave them, we'll never hear from them again. But this is another thing that recurred throughout the book that I think ties back to humility, is that I was amazed at this piece that by the time you left, the guys who you had been with, who were kind of irritated by you, they had already contacted a bunch of people in Flagstaff where you live and told them about your journey. And these people like banded together to help you. And I'm really curious, like, why you think they did that? I mean, to me, it has to have something to do with this humility piece, but like, why did they do that?
That's a great question. I have a theory, and it's not just simply because they're incredibly nice and kind and generous. Although I think that's where the decision they made collectively to help us started. I mean, you know, the world of backpacking and long distance hiking inside the canyon in the desert Southwest is much like the river world. You know, this is a subculture. This is a subculture that's riven by pettiness and insecurity and rivalry. But I would say the best of the subculture is defined by things that transcend those things. It's defined by kindness, generosity, support, a belief in karma. You know, what? Tell me, show me a river guide who doesn't believe in karma, and I'll show you somebody who's pretending to be a river guide but isn't really. And so I think these people, this is a group of dedicated long distance backpackers, most of whom, all of whom live in Flagstaff, all of whom deeply, deeply care about the landscape. And that is the first part of the answer to your question. This project that Pete and I did, I failed to mention, this was an assignment for National Geographic magazine, which Pete has had a relationship with for, I don't know, 25 years. I had never done an assignment for National Geographic up to that point. And the purpose of that assignment, Tracy, was to, you know, we were going to conduct a transect on foot from east to west of Grand Canyon National Park, a park whose landscape is so shattered and whose topography is so broken that there's no trail linking one end to the other. We were going to conduct across the arc of that journey an informal inventory of the secret, some of the secret wonders and treasures that are concealed in the world between the bottom of the canyon along the river and the rims where most people go to gaze into the canyon when they visit this place. And that was going to enable us to say something about a number of threats in the form of industrialized tourism, mining, some other threats that loom over this landscape, and give exposure to threats that have the potential to fundamentally harm the integrity of, you know, the second most visited and I would argue single most iconic park in America. That was the purpose of our journey. And so the reason these people helped us was not just because they were like super nice and kind, and some of them were already our friends and they all believe in karma. They understood that, like, yeah, Pete and I may suck when it comes to like preparing for a long distance backpack and executing a long distance backpack and having some of the skills that we didn't have, like, you know, land navigation and the ability to move up and down slot canyons. But they also understood that, like, the skills that Pete and I have, we are storytellers for better or worse. He is a visual storyteller. I'm a person who tells story in words. And we work together to create stories that hopefully can touch people. And what they wanted was they wanted these two storytellers to move through this landscape. And oh, by the way, you know, this was all taking place. The story was going to be published in 2016 when the centenary of the National Park Service was being celebrated, the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, to say something about the fact that although we as Americans like to think about our national parks, this national park, as landscapes that are sacrosanct and inviolable by virtue of being protected as parks, they're not. They have to be protected. In order to be protected, they need advocates who are willing to fight on their behalf. Otherwise, they will be overrun by forces of greed and people who want to turn beauty into cash. That's just a fact. We wouldn't have these spaces if it wasn't for the fact that each succeeding generation of Americans, some of them have to decide that they matter so much that you have to fight on their behalf. And so that's why, that's the answer to your question. At least that's my answer to your question. That's why these people helped us. That's why they summoned us to their house when we got back to Flagstaff. Over the next 6 weeks, they put us through the hiking equivalent of a makeover. They redid our nutrition program. They redid our packs. They redid our maps. And then they appointed from among themselves minders and babysitters who were going to go back into the canyon and pull us through the canyon until we demonstrated just enough competency that they might be willing to allow us to move through some of the sections on our own.
So incredible. I'm so glad you brought up the conservation piece, like, because I wasn't thinking that. And maybe it's because I'm, you know, halfway through the book and that's going to come to light. But I want to ask you, you know, we have time for a couple more questions. Sadly, I feel like I could talk to you for 2 hours. But so along that line of, you know, minders and I don't know about babysitters, but these people who emerged to teach you. It's like they rose up, or you would come out of the canyon and there'd be one there. And that actually really happened. And that's where I am in the book right now with Renee Yellowhorse, a Navajo woman who you come out, you've gone back into the canyon with your minders after you had your makeover. Love that. And I've many times had to like wish that I had somebody to make over my outdoor abilities. But so you go back down, you have a successful trip, you come back out and you get there and this amazing Navajo woman is standing at the rim of the canyon to deliver like the next message slash piece of your puzzle. And I wonder if you can tell readers about that and what that, just how that felt and how her message felt and how it kind of changed the course of then the rest of your journey.
Well, you're putting your finger on like, so this is yet another theme and dimension to this journey and this experience and the story that emerged from it. And again, it's something that neither Pete nor I fully anticipated. Yes, we were supposed to be doing a story for National Geographic that talked about the threats. And one of the threats was a proposal at the time to build a, you know, a huge new resort complex on what is now the very remote eastern rim of the Grand Canyon along the western side of the Navajo Nation, you know, the largest, the largest Native American reservation in the United States, about the size of West Virginia, which goes right up to the rim and down the walls of the canyon along its western side. And on the rim of the canyon, but they were going to build a giant tramway down the walls of the canyon to a place that is viewed by many, many people, both just ordinary like white folks like you and me, but also every single tribe inside the canyon as a sacred spot. Anybody who's been to the canyon will know this place. It's known as the Confluence. It's where the turquoise waters of the Little Colorado, the largest tributary of the Colorado River inside Grand Canyon, it's where those waters meet and merge with the main stem Colorado. And the tramway was going to conclude right down at the bottom. They were going to build a raised metal walkway and an amphitheater and a restaurant at the Confluence. And it was going to be capable of delivering up to 10,000 people a day down to the bottom of the canyon. So environmentalists and conservationists in the National Park Service were horrified by this, but a more complicated relationship in response to it was unfolding within the Navajo Nation. There were a number of prominent Navajo politicians and business people who actually thought that this might be a good idea because it would do something important. It would bring jobs and prosperity and income to a section of the Navajo reservation that, you know, really struggles economically and has for the better part of the last 150 years. But there were there was another side to the Navajo Nation and the tribe who were fiercely opposed to this, felt that it was entirely inappropriate, acknowledged that, yes, we do need economic development, we do want prosperity, but we have a responsibility to nurture and sustain aspects of our culture that govern our relationship with the land itself and our sense of ourselves as stewards and caretakers of the land. And this project is a violation of all of that. And so this woman, Renee Yellowhorse, was part of the group that was opposed to it. And she wanted to talk to us about the project and her feelings about the project. And what the really unexpected part of it was not just what she had to say to us about why it mattered to her to stand against this, but this was the first in a series of encounters that would unfold across our journey involving meetings with other members of Native American tribes who wanted to speak to us about other development projects, because each one of the development projects that looms over and threatens the landscape of Grand Canyon National Park has a tribal component to it. And what that did was it opened up a whole new dimension, which I am embarrassed and rather ashamed to acknowledge. Despite all of my like alleged expertise and the fact that I had written a book about the bottom of the Grand Canyon, I had never bothered to learn about. And what I'm talking about here, Tracy, you know, and you're familiar with this, perhaps more so than I, but like, you know, there is a history of, there are 11 Native American tribes whose ancestral lands either abut or lie directly inside of what is now Grand Canyon National Park. And each and every one of those tribes has a connection to this landscape that goes back further in time and space than anybody who looks or sounds like me, a middle-aged white guy who's the descendant of white Europeans who came to this continent in the 19th century. Anybody who looks or sounds like me can even begin to imagine. And one of the things that I had never bothered to really think about or familiarize myself with or learn about is the fact that when we created this thing that I have celebrated ever since I was a boy growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, our national parks system, and the fact that we took some of our most gorgeous landscapes and we decided we were going to protect them and pass them along intact to future generations of Americans, that when we created those parks in the first place, each and every one of them was home to people who had been there for thousands of years before we arrived, who understood it at levels that we did not, whose knowledge of and wisdom about the land itself is encoded in their culture and their language and their traditions. And what we did to these people is we physically exiled them from the parks that we then created and congratulated ourselves on having set up in the first place. And then we did something that is almost as bad, maybe worse, I don't know. We wrote them out of the story that we tell ourselves about these places and why they're special. And so the encounters that we had with these Native American members of these tribes who belong to the Grand Canyon, on the surface, these encounters were about specific development projects, but underneath the surface, these encounters were about making us aware that in addition to its incredibly rich geology and biology and all the other aspects of natural history that make this landscape so rich, there is a layer of human history that is largely ignored and has not been acknowledged or celebrated or woven into the fabric of how we understand and experience this national park. And that that was an essential part of our journey, maybe the most important part of it all, because in the end, Tracy, ostensibly, you know, the frame of this book, the frame of this story is like two clueless dudes bumbling their way through this incredibly harsh and incredibly gorgeous landscape. But the heart and the soul of the story are the Native American tribes who were part of this landscape. And here's the thing that they each and every one of them wanted us to understand. The central message they all repeated: we are still here. We are still here. We are still part of this landscape. We are still connected to this landscape. We still consider it our home. We will not be pushed out. We will not be written out of the story. And not only are we a part of the past, and not only are we indelibly tied to the present, but by virtue of the fact that our reservations lie directly alongside of the national park, we hold the power to shape and determine the future of this place as well.
I mean, and I'm so glad that you bring that up and that you just talked about it like you did, because I think this is a good place that we can, you know, now set readers off to do the reading themselves, because that is the actual place where I am in the book. And I love, this is something I love about your writing so much, Kevin, is you're really good at kind of like highlighting this trope of like these bumbling guys or whatever. And I think you do it about yourself, but you are truly one of the most gifted, just insightful, beautifully, you're just a beautiful writer when it comes to the craft of writing and storytelling. But what I think makes your stories transcend others is your heart and how much of your heart you put into these things and how seriously you take them. And I'm actually getting kind of choked up, because I think like anyone could have written a book about two guys, you know, being dragged through the canyon or whatever happened on the actual physical part of the journey, but not everybody could have written a book like the one that you did. And I just think it's a gift, and everybody has to read it, because it is so much more, while being this incredibly entertaining read and page turner. Like, I cannot wait to go back to it right after we're done talking and learn more about this, the Native American aspect. And so I don't know. I'm such a fan anyway. And I just so grateful you're out there in the world writing stuff like this. And I want everyone to get this book, because the New York Times can't be wrong. And the Colorado Sun isn't wrong. That, Kevin, it's amazing book. And I love that it's the follow-up to The Emerald Mile. I just think it's so perfect. And I guess I'll leave the last question I have for you, which I'm sure everybody asks, is like, now what? Do you exit the canyon and write about something different, or do you have more canyon in you?
Oh, God. I mean, a few people have asked me that, but I mean, I think you almost more than anybody else could understand this, Tracy. Like I mean, this book took almost 10, it took a year to just do. And when we were engaged in the hike, we started it in the fall of 2015. We finished in November of 2016. I didn't think there could be anything more miserable or awful than, you know, stumbling through the trailless backcountry of the vertical wilderness inside the canyon. And then I sat down and started to write the book, and it took another 7 years to do that. And that was much harder, not physically, but mentally. And I have made so many sacrifices in my personal life. You know, there's not a holiday or a kid's birthday or a family vacation in the last 7 years that I have not pulled myself away from the people I love to go off in a corner and, you know, work on yet another deadline or read another set of academic papers or tried to outline another chapter in this book. And I'm not thinking about the next adventure. I'm thinking about doing the things that matter to me as much as, indeed more than, the Grand Canyon, which is to, you know, spend time with my family. And I'm also like, I'm 59 years old. It's like, I don't, what are Pete and I going to like go over to the Himalayas now and do like a transect of the, like, I don't think so. I think this may be, it's entirely possible that this may be my last book. And if that's the case, I would be totally fine with it. And I'll say something else too, which is like, look, thank you so much for like the incredibly kind and generous comments you just made about my writing, you know, and taking this stuff seriously. But like, I have to say, like, I'm not that special. You and I and a whole bunch of other people came up, you know, learning to write at magazines, and then we went on to write books, and we love the beauty of the American West and the manner in which the places that you can go to and the landscapes that you can connect to offer the ability to explore dimensions within ourselves and mm-hmm. thereby connect to and perhaps illuminate the special qualities of those landscapes for others. And I'm just not that special. My response to that is like, it's the freaking Grand Canyon. How could you not take it seriously? I don't read my reviews on Amazon and Goodreads. I'm told that there are a number of like 1 or 2 star reviews from people who basically said, you know, the only thing worse than an overly long hike is an overly long book about it. And, you know, my response to that is like, you know what? If that's your response to the Grand Canyon, then you have a problem. And I think that that the writing that all of us do in one way or another is an effort to acknowledge and honor the power of land and landscape and nature and natural beauty and wilderness, that we were touched by these things early in our lives, and we have tried to keep that thread alive in our writing. And you and I have had a 2-decade-long debate with each other about who the better writer is. And you've come up with some compelling arguments to suggest that it might be me, but I know in my heart that you're wrong. And I want to end this conversation by encouraging everyone who listens to this podcast to read Tracy Ross's books. You've done some just beautiful, beautiful work. You're engaged in what's going to be another amazing book when it comes out. And it's great. Our lives are separate and we don't get to see or talk to one another that often, but it's really great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Kevin. And everybody, go out right now and get A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon. And Kevin, I really appreciate you and thank you so much.
Okay, Tracy. Good to hear your voice. You take good care and keep writing, okay?
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Most Colorado oil and gas wells do not generate enough cash to ensure they will be cleaned up, leaving roughly 27,000 at risk of being abandoned when they stop producing. An analysis by the nonprofit Carbon Track says only a handful of basins in the state have wells profitable enough to cover the cost of remediation. Industry representatives are pushing back on those calculations. Colorado currently has 47,000 active wells. In 2022, the state commission that regulates the industry adopted financial assurance regulations requiring every operator to have a cleanup plan. A Nederland Nature Center is creating a new site for its programs in the hope of drawing more people to the outdoors to rewild themselves. The facility is a $13 million project of longtime Nederland nonprofit Wild Bear Nature Center and should open next year. But it has been in the works for more than two decades with a vision of pulling people away from their screens and reacquainting them with the outdoors. The founders see the new center as a gateway to Colorado's backyard where people can rekindle a relationship with their natural surroundings. The US 50 bridge over the Blue Mesa Reservoir will temporarily reopen for the July 4th weekend, restoring a critical route across Colorado for holiday travel. Officials say emergency vehicles and smaller vehicles can begin crossing Middle Bridge west of Gunnison on Wednesday morning. The bridge has been closed since mid-April. It will be open 12 hours a day through the holiday weekend. Starting July 8th, the bridge will open twice a day as crews continue to work on repairs. Heavier vehicles, including RVs, trucks pulling trailers, semi-trucks, and buses, will not be allowed. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect. Issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.